and it is therefore a pleasure to welcome among the better heads of state Rabbi David Silber, who is the founder and the dean of Grisha, one of the most important and innovative institutions in America, in the world, and it has become a tradition of ours that we want to have a Tshuva lecture every year with Rabbi Silber, and so welcome back.
Thank you. Sorry for the delay.
I'm sure it was not easy to get him from point A to point B.
This is not the greatest damage that Gaddafi has done. But anyway, okay, so on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, we read the Binding of Isaac, Achidat Yitzchak, and what I wanted to do this evening is just to share some reflections on this story, which is, in our tradition, a very central story. Central both in the sense that it appears in the liturgy of Rosh Hashanah, for example, in a very pivotal place, but also central in that there are other biblical narratives which play off the story of the Binding of Isaac. So obviously, in the time that we have, we can't really deal with all of the elements and aspects of the story, but I did want to make a couple of observations about the Binding of Isaac. In this translation, it's, of course, chapter 22 of Genesis. In this translation, it's on page 74. And one, I think, important thing to think about when we study the story of Akedat Yitzchak is its place within the book of Genesis. If we think about the book of Genesis in terms of its overall structure, I would say that we could represent the book in the following way. The book of Genesis starts with a story of creation, which is chapter 1, in which God is described as creating heaven and earth in 6 days and resting on the seventh day. It's very orderly. Each day has its own, each day is described as a day in which something is created, culminating in the sixth day of the animals, the human, and the Sabbath, the resting on the seventh day. Second creation story, which begins in chapter 2, is, of course, quite different. And the second creation story, among other things, of course, it focuses on the human and the aspects of what it means to be human. But apart from that, there's something else about the second creation story which sets it apart from the first. And that is that the first story of creation in Genesis, in the beginning God created heaven and earth, describes heaven and earth. Things up in heaven, the sea, the land. But the second creation story of Genesis is not only focused on the human being, but is focused on a particular place. In the second creation story, we are told that this God, who is not known as Elohim in chapter 2, but rather Adonai Elohim or Hashem Elohim, this God, we are told, in chapter 2, this is verse number 8, says, Vayita Adonai Elohim Gan B'Eden Mikedem. Vayasem Sham Et Adam Asher Yatzar. God, this God, Shem Elohim, planted a garden in Eden, in the east, and placed the human being there that God had formed. Later in the story, as we know, chapter 3, continuation of the story, the human eats of the forbidden fruit, and after eating of the forbidden fruit, the man and the woman hide from God. We are told in verse number 8 of chapter 3, on page 11, it says, Vayishu lekol Adonai Elohim, Mitalech Bagan Ruach Hayom. They heard the sound of the Lord walking in the garden toward the end of the cool of the day. So this place that God has created or planted, this Garden of Eden, is a place which the human inhabits, but it's also a place which God inhabits. God is walking in the garden, taking a leisurely stroll towards the end of the day. So, in other words, the first creation account talks about heaven and earth generally. The second creation account is focused on a particular place. Now, as the Torah continues its story, we are told that God regrets that God has created the world. The human being is evil. God decides to undo creation. And we have the account of the flood. Noah is selected, chosen, saved, placed on, built an ark together with his family, a selection of animals, and sets out. And Noah then returns to the world. And when Noah returns to the world, and this is later on in Genesis, in chapter 8, so Noah is commanded in chapter 8, in verse number 16, in this translation on page 31, Tzemen Ateva, leave the ark, and together with all the animals you have brought, Vishatu Ba'aretz, Ufaruv Ravuah Aretz, they shall swarm over the earth and multiply over the earth. Noah goes out with all the animals, etc., and Noah rebuilds the world. Noah recreates the world. It's a different world. It's a world in which evil is already present. The evil inclination is there from the human's youth, says the Torah. And Noah is charged to govern the world. But essentially, what we have is a recreation of the world. What we don't have with Noah, however, is a recreation of the sacred space. There's no intimation at all in the Noah story, no discussion of a particular place, of a sacred place, of a special place that we don't have. So in the story of Noah, it's fair to say what we have is a recreation of chapter 1. Heaven and earth, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, that we have. But we don't have the idea of the garden, which is the idea of sacred space. The idea of sacred space, we discover in chapter 12. In chapter 12, we have God speaking to Avram, as he's known. In chapter 12, verse 1, Zayomer Adonai el Avram, Lech lecha mi'artzicha mi'molaletzicha mi'beit avicha el ha'aretz asher areka. So we have God commanding this Avram, whose genealogy has been traced back to Noah, through his son whose name is Shem. Shem was the son that Noah blessed. And Avram is commanded to go, in the words of the Torah, to the land that I will show you. El ha'aretz asher areka. Avram sets out to the land of Canaan, as we know it, and when he comes into the land, God appears to Avram. In verse number 7 of chapter 12, on page 46, Vayera Adonai el Avram, Vayomer Lezarecha atein et haaretz hazot, Vayiven sham mizbeach Adonai hanireh elav. So we have here the idea of a special place to which Avram has been sent. In contradistinction, I would add, to the previous biblical narrative, the narrative that precedes it is the story of the Tower of Babel. And there we have the opposite. There we have God dispersing humanity. In the case of Avram, Avram is directed towards a particular place, and in the words of the Torah, he's commanded to go Lech Lecha. That's in chapter 12. That's God's first communication with Avram. God's last communication with Abraham, as he's known at that time, is found in chapter 22, our chapter for the evening. After these things, says the Torah, God tested Abraham. Vayomer elav Avraham, and God said, Avraham, Vayomer hineini, and Avram said, hineini, which is the Hebrew, hine ani, here I am. Vayomer, kach not binchad yechidcha asher ahavta et Yitzchak, v'lech lecha eretz amoriyah. So once again he's commanded, lech lecha, to go, to take your son, and to bring him as a sacrifice on one of the mountains, Asher Omar Lecha, that I will tell you. So we have a parallel to the first Lech Lecha, two Lech Lechas. The first is the commandment to go to a sacred land, the Hebrew being Lech Lecha. There's the place that I will show you. In the second instance, it's the place that I will tell you. What they both have in common is he's being directed to a particular place. What's interesting is in the second story, the binding of Isaac, it's not just the sacred land, but one of the governing words of chapter 22, we are told that Avram goes, as God has commanded him. In verse 4, in verse 3, Vayelech al hamakom, he went to the place of which God had spoken. And in verse 4, he lifts up his eyes, Vayaret hamakom erachok, and he saw the place. And then later on in the story, of course, he comes to the place. In verse 9, they come, Vayelech al hamakom, and he came to the place. Then in verse, Avram is about to slay his son, and he stopped. And Avram sees a ram behind him. And Avram goes and brings a sacrifice. In verse 14, Vayikra Avraham, Shem HaMakom Ahu Adonai Yireh, Asher Yamir Hayom, Bahar Adonai Yireh. So we have the repetition over and over of a particular word, which is HaMakom. Makom means place. HaMakom is the place. So Avram is going to the place. Avram not only goes to the place, Avram names the place that God sees or God chooses. Then the Torah adds, which today is known as the place in which God is seen. In other words, what we have in the Torah then is not just a sacred land, but we have a sacred place within the land, a sacred space within the space, HaMakom, the place where God is seen, God is present. Sort of reminds us of the Garden of Eden. And it means that in the creation stories of Genesis, the way it works is there's the creation of the world and sacred space and the undoing of that. Then there's Noah who recreates the world. But there's Abraham who recreates, as it were, and names the sacred space. In other words, to put it this way, if we think about the creation stories of the book of Genesis, creation stories of the book of Genesis are completed in chapter 22 of the book of Genesis. Now, the person who understood this before me, I don't know his name, but it's the person that composed the service for Rosh Hashanah. The one who composed the Rosh Hashanah service and the middle blessing, of course, which is known as remembrances, it's modeled actually on Adam and then Noah and then Abraham. This is the frame for the Zichronot service. Begins with judgment, which in the author of the Zichronot says, Zayom Tchilat Ma'asecha. He calls Rosh Hashanah, this is the day, the beginning of your actions, Tchilat Ma'asecha, a remembrance of the first day. Because in Jewish tradition, in the Midrash, the day of Rosh Hashanah is actually not the first day of creation. It's the sixth day of creation. The day in which the world is created, says the Midrash, on the 25th day of Elul. On the sixth day of creation, which is the day of the human creation, is Rosh Hashanah. According to the Midrash, even though the Torah doesn't seem this way, on the day that the human was created, the human sinned. And according to the Midrash, on the day the human sinned, the human was judged. So in the Rosh Hashanah service, we are saying, Zayom Tchilat Ma'asecha, this is the beginning of your Ma'asecha, and we hear the echo of God's commitment of Ma'aseh Adam. In other words, every Rosh Hashanah, we are entering voluntarily into judgment. In doing so, we are reenacting, as it were, that first day of creation, which is also the first day of sin and judgment. So the beginning of the Zichronot, which is all about judgment, Yom HaDin, we recall Adam. If you recall the service, though, and then the writer describes the judgment and the judge, who knows everything, understands us well, and then, suddenly, in the Rosh Hashanah service, we have the line, Ashrei Ish Elo Yishkacheka. Happy is the one who does not forget you, right? Those who seek you will not be disappointed. And as an example of one, and the ones that seek God, God also seeks. V'yatzah d'resh ma'asei kulam, v'gam et Noach b'yavo zacharta. And you remember Noah. Suddenly Noah takes center stage on Rosh Hashanah. Because he represents, of course, creation. But he also represents the idea of providence, the idea that even though God judges everybody, not all judgments are equal. Those who seek God are not judged the same way as those who don't. I thought Doresh Ma'aseh Kulam, which Rosh means to study carefully, it also means to search, to yearn. I named my school Trisha, actually my father picked the name, it's a good name though. Trisha because it means to search, to study very intensively, but as a religious pursuit, it means to search for something. And then of course the Rosh Hashanah service ends, with the blessing that Baruch Atah Hashem Zocher HaBrit, who remembers the covenant, and we cite before the blessing, actually the binding of Isaac. The binding of Isaac occupies a very strategic place on the Rosh Hashanah service. It means the composer of Zichronot, and the day after was called the Day of Remembrance, Yom HaZikaron, modeled that central prayer on three characters, Adam, Noah, and Abraham. Because after all, Rosh Hashanah is a day which reminds us, which recalls creation. And the writer, very cleverly, probably understanding how Genesis is structured, attaches a particular idea to each of the three. Adam is judgment, Noah is providence, and of course Abraham represents covenant. That's the structure of the middle blessing of Rosh Hashanah. The truth is, when you see this, it's obvious, you know. But I've also had that virtually nobody ever saw it. I mean, it's but it's interesting. Once you do see it, and the importance for our purposes this evening is that I think it confirms a very important truth about the book of Genesis, and that is that we often think of creation stories as chapter 1 or chapter 2, 3, 4. And Abraham is a new story, the first Jew, but it doesn't work that way in Genesis. He is the first Jew, no question. But he's also a continuation, in a sense, completion of the creation narrative. Now, before I get to the main point I want to make about the binding of Isaac and how it functions, and again, it's very complex and there's many aspects to this, and I wanted to pick out just one small point about the binding of Isaac to show how the story perhaps plays out in the book of Genesis, plays out in, I think, in many, many other ways in the Bible as well. But before that, I wanted to make one point about the first verse of the binding of Isaac, which is, on page 74, Fahi achar hadvarim ha'ela, after these things that God tested Abraham. The medievals, and actually even before the medievals, were wondering what does it mean to say that the binding of Isaac took place after these things. After what things? In other words, what is the story that we should connect in the deepest way to the binding of Isaac? And the truth is that there are several possible answers to the question. My own personal view is that they're all true. That this story, which is after all God's last communication, from a certain perspective is the last story. It's after the whole story. It actually ties back to the first Lech Lecha. So it's after everything. This is a completion of the Abraham narrative from a certain perspective. Having said that, it's also clear that this is chapter 22 of Genesis. And now what preceded chapter 22 was chapter 21. So that Rashi, for example, says that after these things, if you want to understand the binding of Isaac, says Rashi, the story you have to study very well is the story of the casting out of Yishmael in the previous chapter, which actually is the reading of the first day of Rosh Hashanah. And Rashi argues that those two stories are inextricably connected in language and in theme. And when one studies, I think, the Torah, one comes to the conclusion that there's a lot of truth to what Rashi is saying. Having said all that, Rashi's grandson, known as the Rashbam, Shmuel ben Meir, who is less known than Rashi, but terribly important commentary on the Torah, who believed that Rashi had gone far afield when he engaged in all this midrashic talk. The Rashbam said to him that his grandfather told, he said, my grandfather told me, that's Rashi, that if he could do it all over again, he would have written a different commentary, much closer to the plain meaning of the text. Apparently he studied with his grandfather. Chumash with Rashi, yes, he studied, because he studied with Rashi. So this is the Rashbam. So the Rashbam typically says, after these things, so it must refer to the previous verse, the previous story. What is the previous story? Previous story on page 73 is the treaty that Abraham makes with King Abimelech, king of the Philistines. The Rashbam's take on this is the following, that in making a treaty with the Philistine king, who was a Canaanite, says the Rashbam, Abraham has sinned grievously, placing his faith in the Canaanite king, and is punished, says the Rashbam, by God testing him and making the point that Abraham's ultimate blessing is the function of Abraham's subservience to God alone and not to Canaanite kings. That's the Rashbam's take on the binding of Isaac. Let me just say straight out, I don't buy it at all. Because I don't think that the punishment is commensurate. I think it's disproportionate. But, on the other hand, what the Rashbam says, that after these things, probably connects to what comes before, does seem to me to make perfect sense. So I think there's a deep truth in what the Rashbam is saying, although I would take it completely differently. But I want to make one small point about the connection to the story that precedes the binding of Isaac. And that is, that in the previous few verses, Abraham makes a treaty with King Abimelech, and the Torah says that Abraham named the place of the treaty Beersheba, for there they both had sworn. And in verse 32, they make a covenant in Beersheba, and Abraham got up, and Abimelech arose with his general and went back to the land of the Philistines. Then it says, "Vayita Eshel Beer." Abraham planted a tree in Beersheba. He called there in the name of the Eternal God, and Abraham dwelt in the land of the Philistines for many, many days. Yamim Rabim, many days or years. Now, what is the significance of those verses? So it strikes me that one of the themes of the Abraham story from beginning to end, we saw this already a bit this evening, is the idea of Lech Lecha. Throughout his life, he's always traveling. There's the first Lech Lecha, there's the last Lech Lecha. In chapter 17, he's commanded, walk before me and be whole. In chapter 13, he's told, Kum hitalech ba'aretz, keep on walking. So the Abraham story is about someone who is, in a sense, on the move or searching for the place, directed to the place. It strikes me that in chapter 21, Abraham believes, after all his wanderings, that he has found the sacred place. He's found the eternal place. Because unlike the other places where he builds an altar, here he actually plants a tree. And of course, a tree is something that's there for a long time. He's thinking long term. He doesn't always call out to God in Beersheba. He calls out to the eternal God, El Olam, the eternal God. And the last verse. So Abraham dwelt in the land of the Philistines for Yamim Rabim, for a long time. He has his covenant with the king. He has his place. He has his sacred tree. He calls out to the eternal God. It sounds like he thinks, after all the wanderings, he has finally discovered, he's found it, the holy place, the sacred place, the Beersheba. After these things, God tested Abraham and said, Abraham, here I am. Take your son, your only son, the one you love, Isaac, v'lech lecha, and bring him up as a sacrifice on one of the mountains that I will tell you. And here there's a very important point, which is the sacred place, Abraham, is not the place that you choose. Actually, in the Bible, it never is. The sacred place, say, in the Torah, in Deuteronomy, is always called the same thing, which is Hamakom Asher Yivchar Adonai. That's what the Torah says. The place that God will choose. Never the place that you choose. It's only the place that God will choose. And the same thing was true in chapter 12, by the way. Go to the place Asher Areka, the place that I will show you. Vayirai Lav Hashem, and God appeared. And then Abraham builds the altar. So that's one of the connections between the previous story and the beginning of the binding of Isaac. To this, we must add the following observation, and then I'll come to the main point I want to make. And that is, that there's an interesting distinction to be drawn between chapter 12 and chapter 22. Chapter 12, when God first speaks to Abraham, Lech Lecha, God said to Abraham, go to the place Asher Areka, the place that I will show you. But in chapter 22, the term is Hamakom Asher Omar Elecha, the place that I will tell you. The Torah in 22 does not use the term, never describes God as showing Abraham the place. And yet, the verb to see, lirot, does appear in chapter 22, but in a different way. And that is, in chapter 22, the Torah reserves the idea of seeing for Abraham himself, and in two different ways. First is in chapter 22, verse number 4, we were told that Abraham set out to go, Vayomai Shrishi, on the third day, Vayisa Avraham et Einav, Vayareta Makome Rachok, he saw the place from a distance. So he sees it from far away. And then later in the story, when he's told not to sacrifice his son, when the angel calls down from heaven, Avraham, Avraham, and he says, Hineni, then the angel says, don't do it, you passed the test, you're a God-fearing human, very good, God-fearing person. And then it says, and Abraham lifted up his eyes, in verse number 13, and he saw, behold, a ram behind him, entangled in the brush. Once again, the Torah has him lifting his eyes and seeing, Yirot, but again, seeing something that's very difficult to see. In the first instance, he sees something very far away. But in the second instance, if we take the term achar to mean behind him, it means he sees something which is actually not in his line of vision at all. it's behind him, which raises the question, how can you see something that is behind you? I'll get to that in a second. But the point is that the Torah has actually preserved the idea of seeing, but presented differently in 22. In 12, God shows him. But in 22, you get the sense that of his own accord, and it's not easy, he sees things that are difficult to see. God has chosen the place, but Abraham is able to see the place that God has chosen. And I think the point over here is that the place is chosen by God, but the human being has to figure out what does God choose? What does God want? Easier said than done. How do we know? And the point, I think, of the Torah is that, I mean, the Torah doesn't tell us how one reaches that place. Is it by studying texts? Is it through life experience? Is it through life failure? There are many ways to attempt to be in a situation or put ourselves in a situation where we can figure out what God has chosen. But the point of the chapter is, you know, if you're very close to another person, let's say, and really deeply connected to another person, it could be a deep, good, great friend, it could be a spouse, it could be a child, whatever, parents, could be. And so someone says, what does so-and-so think about this issue? And I say, well, so-and-so believes this and that, and how do you know that she believes that? Well, I know very well. That's the point. The point is, supposed to be in sync, actually. And the point of the, and when you're in sync, you make the right autonomous choices. You make the correct moral choices. That, I think, is the point of the binding of Isaac. It's Abraham's ability, finally, at this point in his life, to see, he's not told about a ram, but he understands. God said, sacrifice Isaac. God earlier said, don't sacrifice Isaac. Through Isaac is the covenant. Okay, there's a contradiction. How do I resolve this contradiction? It must be that there is a proxy, that there is a substitute, which is simultaneously not Isaac, but also is Isaac, which is the idea of sacrifice. He sees the ram behind him because it's got to be there. He knows it's got to be there because he understands at this point what God is commanding. But yet the place is not chosen by Abraham. The place is chosen by God and by God alone. It's a very Rosh Hashanah idea. You know, I think I mentioned a couple of years ago when I was here that I used to teach for the Wexner Foundation many years ago. About 10 years ago, I got a phone call from some fellow in Seattle. He was very troubled, very troubled. He had gone to the South Pacific, and he had gone scuba diving, where you see these like amazing creatures that he didn't know existed. So he called up, he must have spoken maybe to his rabbi or somebody out there in Seattle, and he said, the question was, I don't know, what are they here for? All these millions of creatures, never see them. And he had gotten some answer he wasn't satisfied with, so he called me up. Anyway, so I said to him, you're making a basic mistake, I said. Because let me tell you something, when you went diving into that water, all the fish said to themselves, what is this guy doing here? Well, you're assuming they're there for you. Why do you assume it? We live in God's world, and so do they. So the point is, that's Rosh Hashanah. That's God's kingship. It means, don't think it's your world. Yom Kippur is different. But Rosh Hashanah is, it's not your world. And that's the point. The place is chosen by God. The human responsibility is to try to figure out as best we can, what does God demand of us? Where is the sacred space? Abraham succeeds after many failures, succeeds in chapter 22. And what I wanted to do this evening, there's a lot to talk about because, you know, in our tradition, this is a very important story. If someone asks you, what makes it important? That's a good question. You know, I remember the first time I picked up the Christian Bible, I was reading it, and I was with a friend of mine, and I said, I'm reading the story, it's very interesting, you know, whatever, it's fascinating from 100 perspectives. And then she said, this is a very important story. It's very important. And to me, why is the story important? What she meant was that in her tradition, in the particular, this is a story which plays a very central role. And it, as an outsider, I couldn't really know that. And the same thing is true of our own tradition. The binding of Isaac is a terribly important story, and the evidence that this is true is that elsewhere in the Bible, they use this story to tell their story. Now, I will give you one example of where the Torah, there are actually several excellent examples, but I'll give you one example of where the Torah, of one place where the Torah uses the binding of Isaac. The binding of Isaac, as I described it, and this is just a small slice of what it's about, is about discovering Hamakom, the place, the sacred space, which Abraham does at the end of his life. This is God's last communication with Abraham. And it takes place, for example, after Ishmael has been banished, which was very painful for Abraham to do. The thing was evil in his eyes on account of his son. But he does it. After that, he's able to see, and he's able to discover Hamakom. What's interesting is that the term Hamakom, the chosen place, resurfaces just a few chapters later. This is chapter 22. And Hamakom resurfaces in chapter 28. Chapter 28, verse number 10, which begins by Yetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva v'yelech Harana. So Jacob left Be'er Sheva and he went to Haran. Jacob is forced to run away from home. His brother threatens to kill him, and furthermore, he's also sent by his parents to the house of Rebekah to find a wife. So there are two purposes in leaving. One is his own safety, and the other is to find a wife who will be a covenantal partner. So Jacob sets out from Be'er Sheva, and he heads towards Haran. Haran being up north, the birthplace of his mother, and the home of his uncle. And the second verse is Vayifka Bamakom. He encounters the place, Hamakom. And the Torah continues, Vayikach me'avnei Hamakom. He took of the rocks of the place, Vayosem Rashotav, and he put them under his head, Vayishkav Bamakom Ahu, and he went to sleep in the place. In the first verse, verse 11, three times, so you can't miss it. The Torah has not a place, but the place. He encounters the place. It took Abraham a lifetime to encounter the place, but Jacob encounters the place right away. Interesting is, of course, the first verse, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva, he leaves Be'er Sheva. In the Akedah narrative, it's also after Be'er Sheva. He leaves Be'er Sheva. He's directed by God to leave Be'er Sheva. Go to the place that I will tell you. In the case of Jacob, he runs away, and it's clear. He has absolutely no idea where he is. If he had an idea, he wouldn't go to sleep there. And Yishkav Bamakomahu, he comes to the holiest place in the world, and he goes to sleep. When he goes to sleep, he has a dream. In this dream, there's a staircase or a ladder to heaven. Angels of God are ascending and descending, and God speaks to Jacob in this dream. And God makes promises to Jacob about covenantal promises. And God promises to bring Jacob back to the land and not to forsake Jacob. And after Jacob wakes up from his dream, in verse number 16, Vayikatz Yaakov Mishnato, so Jacob arose from his slumber. Vayomer, he said, Achein Yesh Adonai Bamakom Hazeh, V'Anochi Lo Yadati. He said, surely God is found in the place, Bamakom, in this place, and I didn't know it. And he was frightened and said, how terrifying, how terrible is this place? Surely this is none other than Beit Elohim, the house of God, and the gate to heaven. And then in verse 19, he named the place Beit El. The word Makom appears six times. It's interesting. You know, it's true that I think in the ancient Near East, it's certainly true in the Torah, that the number 10 is a creation number. It's interesting that the term Makom appears four times in the binding of Isaac and six additional times in the story of the Jacob HaMakom, which is the Torah's way of saying, I think, 6 plus 4 is 10. That these two stories, in other words, the binding of Isaac is the culmination of creation. It's the discovery of the alternative sacred space, the alternate for the Garden of Eden, which is the land of Canaan, which is the holy place, the house of God, place that God sees or chooses. And now Jacob comes to the very same place. I don't care if it's geographically the same or not, it's irrelevant. But it's conceptually the same place. Hamakom. This time, of course, he's sound asleep. He doesn't know. And he realizes, he recognizes, I've slept in the holiest place. I didn't know. Anochi lo yadati. It's interesting that in the Abraham narrative, in the Akedah, what does God say when Abraham passes the test? Ki ata yadati. Now I know that you are a God-fearing person. The Torah preserves the language, but here it's lo yadati. He doesn't know. But let me say a small digression, thought of recently. When I was in Israel recently, so someone gave me, there's a fellow named Dr. Breuer who wrote on the Bible, very interesting. So Breuer, actually, his work was trying to resolve modern biblical scholarship with his religious sensibilities. In other words, for example, we all know that in the last 100 years or more than that, the documentary hypothesis has taken played a very prominent role. The idea that the Torah consists of a set of documents and that one can, in fact, the claim goes, identify different pieces of the Torah as to which document they belong to, raised all kinds of questions about the Torah authorship and actually what the Torah is saying. Is it some kind of unitary work? Is it just sort of piecemeal put together or whatever? One of the foundations of the documentary hypothesis was the fact that in various parts of the Torah, God is called differently. God has different names. So that, for example, in chapter 1 of Genesis, it's Elohim. That's the only name that's used. In chapter 2 of Genesis, Adonai, the eternal Elohim, is used consistently, and only that is used many times in chapter 2. So the argument went, and I think still goes, actually, that this is a demonstration that these are two different documents, two different authors, two different names of God. Now, I don't want to get into the whole documentary hypothesis issue. But I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying something else. I don't believe in accepting something just because people say it. I think it has to be looked at. And even though it's Holy of Holies in biblical scholarship, I think one can raise many questions about it. But when it comes to chapter 1 and 2 of Genesis, and Breuer brought it hook, line, and sinker, I got to say. Now, to me, I must tell you the truth, confess, I am just a plain Muhammad. But I'll tell you something. To me, it demonstrates exactly the opposite. I'll tell you why. It's the only place we have in the entire Bible, the only place where we have a consistent use of Hashem Elohim, Adonai. We have the names of God, but the idea of Adonai Elohim says one thing to me. And they have originally been two documents, it doesn't bother me in the least. But that the one who writes the Torah, Moses, God, or someone else named Moses, as Moses writes, who cares? But the point is, it doesn't matter. But Elohim is the name used for the creating God of chapter 1. Adonai Elohim says to me, because the only place it's ever used, that the writer, that the Torah is saying, yes, we have the creation story of chapter 1, but now I'm going to tell you something in addition to that, which is focused on the human, because the Adonai name, that particular name, Yud-Heh, Vav-Heh, is often the personal God. I want to tell you about, yes, there is a God who creates everything, but there's also the personal God. Now I'll tell you something interesting that I discovered. Interesting. I was just teaching I teach Talmud now for the first time in several years. The Talmud has a statement about somebody. He got up that morning, it says, and he said the blessings of the Shema, and he said Shema Esrei just at sunset, and he was smiling the whole day. He's so happy. I've been smiling the whole day. I'll tell you what I discovered. When you read the Binding of Isaac, you have two different names for God in the Binding of Isaac. After these things, let's take a look. I think this is interesting. I don't think it's an accent. Let's see. After these things, verse number 1, Elohim Nisa et Abraham. That's Elohim, right? Let's see. Where do we have it again? Verse number 3, he went to the place Asher Amar Elohim. That's 2. Right? Then we have, let's see. Abraham said, Father, where's the sacrifice? Verse 8, Elohim Yerelo Haseli Olabani. That's 3. Verse number 9, they went to the place Asher Amar Elohim. That's 4, right? Then verse 11, Vayikra Elav Malach Adonai. That's 1, right? Hineni. Right? Now we have Kirei Elohim Atah, 5-1. Abraham looked up, right? Vayikra Abraham, Shema Makamahu Adonai Yireh, that's 5-2. Asher Yamir Yom Bahar Adonai Yireh, that's 5-3. Vayikra Malach Adonai Abraham, that's 5-4. Vayom Abinish Bati Num Adonai, that's 5-5. It means you have it 10 times in this chapter. 5 times the name Hashem, and 5 times Elohim. Do you think it's an accident? There's no way. And of course, it confirms what I said before is 100% correct. That the story of the binding of Isaac is a recapitulation or a variation on chapter 2 and 3 of Genesis, the creation of the sacred space. Now, in that chapter, only Adonai Elohim appears. No other name appears. Here's the point, okay? Let me tell you something which is very important about this. First of all, it's beyond belief, actually. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, there's no way this can be an accident. But I'll tell you something very interesting. Here's what I take from this. I take from this something about myself. I know nothing. That's what I take from it. I taught all these years. I never saw this. And if you didn't see this, then there's another 100 things you're not seeing either. It's clear. I mean, the point is, I'm not getting into documents, authors. I'm making a different point. What you have over here, this thing is being put together in a most interesting way. Now, let me get to the main point I want to make about this purpose this evening of the binding of Isaac. What we have over here in chapter 28 is once again we encounter the sacred space. But this time, Jacob encounters the sacred space not at the end of his career, but at the beginning of his career. Not only that, he goes to sleep. When he goes to sleep, though, God speaks to him. God speaks to Jacob. He sees these, the term, often dream sequences, you have in the Torah the term Hinei Sulam, Hinei Malach Elohim, Hinei Adonai Nitzav Alav, etc. In the last verse when God speaks to Jacob, verse number 15 on page 106, God says to Jacob, Hinei Anochi Imach, and behold, I am with you. I will protect you where you go. Shmaticha, I will bring you back. I will not forsake you. Okay. Jacob wakes up. And what's interesting is, first of all, Jacob was sent away by his mother to get a wife and to run away from his Esau, the brother. She said to him, you will go for a few days till I call you back. You know? Suddenly he's setting out on this trip and God appears to him. Jacob, don't worry, I'm going to protect you. I won't abandon you. I'm going to bring you back home. And Jacob may be thinking, I'm going for 2 weeks. I'm the 2 week vacation to my uncle. What is this? But, of course, the reader understands at the time when God says, I'm going to protect you, means you need protection. I'm going to guard you, protect you, won't abandon you, etc. If Hinei Anochi Imach is the last verse, and behold, I am with you. Now, Hinei Anochi Imach, Anochi, of course, is the emphatic Ani. Hinei Ani Imach. Hinei Ani, of course, is usually contracted in the rest of the Torah. Hinei Ani means Hineni. What's interesting is that in this chapter, chapter 28, in chapter 28, God says Hineni to Jacob. See, in the Abraham story, Abraham said Hineni. Abraham said Hineni. Here, God says Hineni. Now, let me just explain. There's one little point I want to make about this. But in order to make the little point, I want to preface it with something that my wife taught me many, many years ago. Many years ago. And I can't get into the whole detail of it. It's an excellent point about the Torah. The point she made was this. This is chapter 28. Chapter 27 is the story where Jacob pretends to be Esau. His mother dresses him up. He speaks, you know, he takes the blessing that Isaac had intended to give Esau. So Yaakov takes the blessing. What Devorah pointed out about chapter 27 is that when you look at chapter 27, there are four characters in the great drama. There's Isaac, there's Rebekah, and there's Jacob and Esau, the twins. In other words, what Isaac intends to do is to transfer a blessing from himself to his son. In this instance, Esau. The point is that this transfer story of 27 is not the first transfer story. The blessing has already been transferred, as it were, in chapter 22, in the binding of Isaac, where Abraham will be blessed through Isaac. When you look at chapter 22, what you notice is that in that story, God is the commander. God speaks to Abraham, and Abraham responds. God's command to Abraham basically was consisted of two main words. One is kach, and the other is lech. Take your son and go, and bring him up as a sacrifice. And Abraham's answer to God, even before the command, was, hineni, I am here. At the end of the story, Abraham's about to slaughter his son, the angel calls down from heaven, and says, Abraham, Abraham, ayomer hineni, again hineni, don't do it. Abraham sees the ram behind him, and the Torah says, Vayelech Abraham, Vayikach et ayu, Vayaleu v'yalatach et b'no. We have the three verbs, go, and take, and sacrifice, which were the initial three words of the command. Kach lo adincha v'lechucha v'yaleu shav v'yalah. Among other things, by the way, I might add, it demonstrates that the Torah is representing Abraham as perfectly fulfilling God's command. You may have heard otherwise from many people. He should have argued, he should have done that. Those are all good questions. I can't deal with them now. But one thing is for sure, that interpretation, it does not represent the best interpretation of this particular text. The Torah preserves exactly the language. Kach lechen ha'leu, which the first time it says he goes and he brings. He also hews the wood for sacrifice. Atzei olah, preserves all. And at the end, he actually does all three. And what's interesting is this. So in the Abraham transfer story, the commander says kach and lech, and Abraham says hineni. What Devorah noticed about chapter 27 is this, that in 27, when Isaac commands his son Esav to go to the field to bring back an animal, so I should bless you, Esav's answer in 27 is hineni. That's how 27 begins. Bini, v'yomer elav hineni. It's the first verse. Esav says hineni. But when Isaac commands him, he uses all kinds of verbs. But he never says kach or lech. Those two verbs he never uses. Then Rebecca overhears what's going on, and she calls Jacob in, Yaakov, my son, your father's going to bless Esav, no good. So I'll tell you what you have to do in verse 9. Lech me'elatzon, go to the flock, v'kach li misham, and take. Then Jacob objects, mother, maybe I'm so smooth, he's hairy, don't worry about that, the curse is on me, she says. Don't worry about that, she says. Do what I tell you to do. Do what I tell you to do. So it, like you, verse 13. Alike, don't worry, the curse is on me. Ach shema b'koli, v'lech kach li. She says, repeats it. And actually, that's the end of what you, so Rebecca says kach v'lech twice. In other words, her divorce point. Rebecca understands, language means when you have the right language, you understand it. Sometimes people say, I said, can you explain that to me? I understand it, but I can't explain it. I say, that means you don't understand it. If you understand it, you can always explain it. There's no such thing. If you understand it well, you can explain it. You'll find a way to explain it. Notice, not knowing the language means Isaac doesn't understand the blessing. I can't get into this now. Rebecca understands perfectly. But the problem is she can't bless. Blessings from father to son in Genesis. Esav says, hineni. But he's the wrong guy. Jacob doesn't say hineni. Now, at the end of the story, when Rebecca goes to Isaac and complains about the Canaanite wives, Isaac calls Jacob in and says, Lech, go, the Kachisha. Says Kach Lech at the end. What is missing in chapter 27 is Jacob never says Hineni. So the student of the Torah is waiting for the missing Hineni. Now, I mention that very cryptically. There's a lot of great wisdom there, but I can't get into that. But the point I would add is that in chapter 28, it's God that says Hineni. So it actually reinforces the fact Hineni. Jacob should be saying Hineni when he comes to Hamakom, but he doesn't. Where does Jacob say Hineni? So Jacob does say Hineni if you move ahead in the Torah in chapter 46. Chapter 46, and with this I will conclude my brief session on the Kedat Yitzchak. 46 is he's told that Joseph is alive. He wants to see his son before he dies. But his son, page 172. So Vayisai Yisrael, so Israel traveled with all his possession. And where does he go? Of course, we can write it ourselves. Vayavo Be'er Sheva. He went to Be'er Sheva again, to the point of jumping off. Right? The place you leave. And he brought sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. So God spoke to Israel in a vision of night. Vayomer Yaakov, Yaakov. Jacob, Jacob. Vayomer Hineni. And he said, here I am. Vayomer, and God said, I am the God of your father. Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. I will make you there a great nation. Anochi eredimcha mitzrayim, I will bring you down. Vayonochi alcha gam alo, and I will bring you up. And Joseph will be there when you die. And what's interesting is that, of course, when you read these verses in Genesis, Jacob again leaves from Beersheba, they remind us of the first time he left from Beersheba. In particular, two things, actually there's several interesting features. The first time he left Beersheba, he had a dream, and he sees a staircase or a ladder to heaven. And the Torah says, Malachei Elohim Olim V'Yordim Bo, the angels of God were going up and down, Olim V'Yordim. In 46, when Jacob says, Hineni, God says to Jacob, don't be afraid to go. Right? Al Tira, don't be afraid. Anochi Eredim Cha Mitzrayim, I will go down there with you. Anochi Al Cha Gam Alo, I will bring you up. You have exactly the same two terms of going down, but this time, it's God who personally says, and of course, in each case, they leave Beersheba, but there's something else about both stories that's parallel, which is, in each of the two stories, Jacob's intention is leaving is other than what God says to him. The first time, he's going off to see his uncle for a few weeks, a few days, literally. Get a wife, you're going to come home. And God says, not what you think. It's not a few days. You're going to be there a very, very long time. But don't worry. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to take care of you. And when Jacob wakes up, Vayira, he was frightened. Over here, you have the same, Altira Yaakov, don't be afraid. But it's the same thing. Jacob said earlier in chapter 45, I will see Joseph before I die. You get the sense he's going to visit his son, his long-lost son. He wants to see him. Says God to Jacob, not what you think. You're not visiting Joseph. He'll be there when you die. You're going there forever. You're never returning. I'm going to bring you back after you die. So in each of the two instances, God is correcting the perception, perhaps, of Jacob, who leaves Beersheba. What's interesting is that the first time he leaves Beersheba, he left Beersheba to go to the house of his uncle Laban. In the second instance, he leaves Beersheba, and Jacob goes to the land of Egypt, where he is taken back after his death, but his descendants remain in Egypt. And that's where they encounter the suffering and the slavery and the persecution and being a stranger and all the covenantal terms we have in Genesis of Geirut and Avdut and Inui. Now we conclude with the following thought about the Hineni. Because it's like this, you see, Abraham's role in the book is to uncover or discover the sacred place, which he does at the end of his life, after all the struggles, and he finally comes to an understanding at the end of his life. Jacob discovers the sacred place at the beginning of his career. He has a different role, which is the role of returning to the sacred place. Jacob is about figuring out how to get back, how to recover. It's not discover, but how to recover, how to reconnect. That's what Jacob is all about. And what's interesting is, when Jacob says, Hineni, what Jacob is saying when he says Hineni is, he's accepting everything that will happen in the land of Egypt. What happens in the land of Egypt is described in the beginning of the book of Exodus. Slavery, persecution, being a stranger, Geirut, Avdut, Inui, the covenantal terms that, of the promise given to Abraham in chapter 15. And those covenantal terms of Geirut and Avdut and Inui, it turns out, are precisely the same three terms we encounter when we study the experience of Jacob in the house of Laban. In other words, what you have here in the story, and this is, I think, the most important point of the evening, as far as this presentation is concerned, the argument what I'm suggesting is that Jacob basically is being sent to repeat, as it were, his experience in the house of his uncle Laban, which he describes himself in chapter 31 as, I was a slave. On ye, I suffered. And then he says later, Imlovan Garti, I was a ger, I was a stranger. Those three terms are used, precisely the same three terms are used in chapter 1 and 2 of Exodus in describing Israel in the land of Egypt. And my point about the Hineni is that I think what we have over here, because God said to Abraham, we have a covenant about the land. Those who suffer and are persecuted and are strangers will ultimately possess the land. And what you have over here is, in the person of Jacob, somebody who explicitly, I think, is saying Hineni, which is, I'm willing to pay the price. I'm willing to experience what I once experienced. He's actually accepting, as it were, the Gerut and the Abdut and the Inui. So this is the Nisig Hineni. The Nisig Hineni, Abraham, Abraham, Hineni, Jacob, Jacob, Hineni. It's exactly playing off Akedat Yitzchak. In the first Be'er Sheva story, it was God that said Hineni. But in the second Be'er Sheva story, at this pivotal moment, it's Jacob was able to respond Hineni. This is the covenantal term of the book of Genesis. And of course, what it's setting up for us is the story of the Exodus, which follows, the story of the suffering in Egypt, which follows, in which Israel is undergoing this covenantal experience. So here we have Jacob, I think, or one might say the text, is reconnecting us to the story of the binding of Isaac, which is, again, in a sense, a completion of creation, and the rest of the book of Genesis is about how does one get back to that place. One gets back to the place in Genesis, certainly, through struggle and through suffering. And in the book of Genesis, there are those who don't want to accept that suffering, which is perfectly fine. But Jacob, in chapter 46, is accepting the suffering. So anyway, look, I'm glad I made it here this evening.
So are we.
And, you know, I want to say one last word. This one last word, which is, the idea of Hineni, I think, is actually a very important idea, because I was thinking about Yom Kippur and about Hineni. Of course, we read the Akedah on Rosh Hashanah. What strikes me about Hineni, Hinei Ani, to me what it says is this, that, you know, very often in life, we're called upon to do things. Sometimes they're very difficult. And sometimes we look around to see who else is going to help us, who's going to do it. Maybe someone else will do it first, we'll have to do it. And what Hineni is about is saying, there is nobody else. This is my responsibility. And it's true of Jacob, certainly, who goes down to Egypt. It's quite clear when one reads the Torah that Jacob understands what awaits him, and probably no one else does. His kids certainly don't. He understands it because he experienced it once before. He knows what it means to be in exile. And that basically what's so striking about the Yom Kippur service, among other things, is that in the two highlights of the service, which is one, the service of the high priest on Yom Kippur, which the Torah says clearly, the high priest enters the Holy of Holies alone. No one else is allowed to be there. But it's equally true of the other great piece of the service, which is the Yud Gimel Midot, Hashem Hashem Kerachum V'chanun, which of course is one of the central features of the story of the golden calf. And when Moses comes down that mountain to and meets up with those who have made the golden calf, or worship the golden calf, or participated, which is everybody, he's completely and totally by himself, and he has two choices: to give up, or to confront the ego. And he confronts, and he's able even to bring some people to his side, and he's able to move the people forward and to establish the covenant and to reconcile. So what, to me, what that's about, both of these two pieces, the high priest in the Holy of Holies and Moses who descends the mountain, it's about Hineni. It's about saying, there is nobody else. I mean, the funny part is, when we operate with that assumption, you know what, there always is somebody else. But the first step is our own Hineni. Anyway, wish everybody a Gemar Chatzimah Tovah. Okay, we have a couple of few minutes. If anybody has any comments or questions, I'm happy to try to respond. What?